all across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
Well, hey there, Wisconsin. Good morning. It is Thursday, April 20th. Welcome to the State of Wisconsin Sense on the shores of Lake Wissota. It's another beautiful day up north. Nice to have you along. Coming up this morning, in our 6 o'clock hour, we'll cover a couple of subjects. First off, some fishy Republican politics up north. We'll talk about a proposal that could allow tens of thousands of acres of forest land to stay in private hands and stay on the tax rolls, still be used for recreation, forestry jobs, and more. And yet Republicans in the legislature are holding things up, and you have to wonder if it's for development. Is it for mining? What's their game? We'll take a look at some of the background. Well, also, because of April 20th, 420 is a noteworthy day for fans of legalized marijuana, we will play back our interview with Kyle Kaminsky from our sister publication in Michigan, The Gander. And he also writes a newsletter on legal marijuana issues called The Michiganja Report, that's it. And he tells us about what it's been like in Michigan these past couple of years and the things that Wisconsin may be missing out on that Michigan has been benefiting from, including Wisconsin customers who cross the border to go into Michigan or Illinois, where it's legal as well. In our 7 o'clock hour, a couple of subjects as well. We will talk at the top of the hour to State Representative Katrina Shanklin. She will talk about the legislation that she introduces around this time every session because it's Earth Day on Saturday. And there are some more good ideas out there that could help protect Wisconsin's amazing natural resources. And yet every year with Republicans in charge of the legislature, they haven't received the support that they deserve. And then at 7:30 in our hometown health segment, Dr. Kristen Lyerly is here with Dr. Ava Igler, who is a pediatric psychologist, and they will talk about the real harm being done by politicians when they punch down, attacking children who are undergoing questions about sexuality and gender. Plus, Luke Mathers will be here, and I will be shamelessly looking for ideas for a new Up North News coffee mug and maybe a shirt or a hoodie or something. So if you have some ideas for slogans, catchy sayings, things about Wisconsin, we'll look for those. And I've got to give away a couple of tickets to Sunday afternoon's Brewers game against the Boston Red Sox. So we're going to crowdsource, you know, the best way to go about doing that as well. So if you want to join us for any of these things, any of these ideas, maybe the tickets, maybe the points that you want to make on any of our four big subjects today, our phone number is 844-967-2789 or 715-388-7155. And our email address is radio@upnorthnewswi.com. Aaron Zommers is down in the Madison studio. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning.
I was looking at some items that we've had such a busy week. I haven't been able to get to a few things here. And did you know, we might have talked about this a month or two ago, because of the Inflation Reduction Act and the extra funding going to the IRS. Remember, the Republicans were saying, oh, they're going to hire 87,000 new agents and it's going to be war on taxpayers, when that was never the case. And where the assets went was to actual customer service.
What?
And so if you called the IRS with a question, instead of waiting forever or nobody answering the phone at all, your call and your question actually got answered promptly. It's crazy, you know, that if you actually take care of customer service, you know, you'll get better ratings and people will be more likely to pay their taxes and do well for government revenue. It's a mystery, isn't it?
Yeah, a few years ago, I had to do my grandma's taxes, and she had some weird situations where I had to call the IRS, and I had enough calls that I waited forever and then got dropped that I memorized the numbers I had to press to get through the menus as fast as I could.
See, it shouldn't have to be that way. It just shouldn't. So I remember I wanted to pass that note along yesterday, that they're one of the many more good influences from the Inflation Reduction Act that passed through Congress. I hasten to add, without any Republican support. Sports real quick here. The Brewers played yesterday afternoon in Seattle, wrapping up that 10-game road trip and wrapping it up splendidly, going 7-3 on the road trip. Eric Lauer pitched into the eighth inning, He allowed just four hits over 7 2/3. Bryce Turang hit a go-ahead single and scored in a five-run seventh inning as the Brewers completed their three-game sweep over the Mariners with a 5-3 win yesterday. The Brewers are off today, heading back home after that long trip out west. They have a three-game series starting tomorrow night against the Boston Red Sox, followed by three games against the Detroit Tigers, and then three against the Anaheim Angels. And then it was a mystery to both me and Aaron as far as how the Bucks did in game two of their first-round NBA playoff series against the Miami Heat. You know, recall they lost the first game, and Giannis went out with a bruised lower back. And so he did not play last night. But on that particular night, last night, the Bucks made up for his absence just fine. Brooke Lopez scored 25 points. Drew Holiday added 24, and the hot shooting Bucks trounced Miami 138-122, tying that Eastern Conference first-round playoff series at a game apiece. The Bucks made 25 three-pointers. They shot 25 of 49 to match an NBA record for three-pointers in a game. So maybe I'm kind of glad I didn't see it, because, you know, we've talked about how I'm not a big fan of the three-point shot. They made 25, but that also means they missed 24 of them, and that's 24 opportunities for me to go, why did they do this? Why don't they just go to the basket and shoot? So it's probably good that Grandpa didn't watch the game.
Fair enough. Yeah, I know my roommate stayed up to watch it, but I was fast asleep.
Oh, yeah. We've got better odds of watching Game 3. That's in Miami. That's on Saturday. 6:30 Central Time is the start on there. All right. We'll talk about some fishy politics up north with trying to protect tens of thousands of acres of forest land up here. I'll have that and much more next on Up North News Radio for this Thursday. I didn't know before. This is not a Santana song originally. This is from a legend in cha-cha and Latin music, Tito Puente. And he originally put Oye Como Va out in 1962. Santana did a remake in 1970. And that's what everybody is listening to. But I thought that was pretty cool. And we're going to talk about, why are we mentioning Tito Puente? Stick around for today's music break and history lesson coming up in just a little while. I have been following, as a lot of folks have been around, northern Wisconsin, a proposal that would help create the largest land conservation project in Wisconsin history. And I need to stop right there and ask, when you hear me say land conservation project, what do you think of? If the first thing that you think of is, this land is all going to be fenced off and nobody's going to be allowed to go on it and no maintenance is going to be done, and so all the forest land in there is going to be overgrown and such. No. No, that's not what a land conservation project is. I mean, it could be, but in this case, it most definitely is not. But what you do have is a plan for that forest land so that there can be sustainable forestry done in there. You can still do a lot of logging, a lot of timber operations. You can do a lot of recreation. You can even do development. You can develop it in a way that it protects the land as much as possible, as opposed to just let whatever happens willy-nilly. If somebody wants to come in, bulldoze a couple of acres, lay down some blacktop and put up a gift shop or a condo or a golf course, and no matter where the runoff goes, that's just the free market at work, right? Sure. But what good does that do you then when all you're left with are tree stumps and blacktop? And so thankfully, there are individuals and there are groups that try to make sure that some of this forest land is managed properly, is conserved to an extent, but is still used, still makes money for, you know, for smart development, for tourists that come in and visitors, hunting, fishing, recreational vehicles, you name it. That can all still be done in a conservation project, but opponents, motivated for whatever reason, maybe they're just all pro, you know, willy-nilly development. Maybe there's something more nefarious at work here. These are folks that want to give the impression that a land conservation project puts a padlock on land up north. And that's not what this particular project is about in an area called the Pelican River Forest, a little east of Rhinelander. And this parcel that we're talking about, 56,000 acres, would be purchased from a group that has it right now for $15 million. Now, most of that $15 million, it has already been committed, most of it from the U.S. Forest Service, which would pay $11 million, and a grant from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, which would put up $600,000. And so what's left is $4 million, which the group wanting to sell this is seeking from the state to ensure, basically as a sign of commitment from the state, that family-oriented, nature-based recreation would still take place there. You would still be conserving working forest land to support a forest products industry that is worth about $25 billion to Wisconsin. So you're saying, okay, who has this land? What was it before? It was once upon a time in the hands of, you know, some of the lumber companies from back in the day. And then it went into other, you know, other companies, other ownership. Eventually, in time, a Virginia-based national land conservation group known as the Conservation Fund bought the land, bought it in 2021 to protect the wildlife habitat while continuing sustainable timber harvesting, as well as some recreational uses such as hunting and fishing. And a lot of this information, we talked already to our friend Joe Hovell. He's with the group Partners in Forestry, and a lot of what you're hearing here is information that he provided to us earlier about the project. So we left this with most of the money to buy this from the conservation fund, but then it would stay in private hands. That project needs $4 million from the state. The state has money set aside for things like this. It's called the stewardship program, the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program. But to have the state spend the $4 million means that it has to be approved by legislators on the Joint Finance Committee. Yeah, that Joint Finance Committee, the one with 12 Republicans and 4 Democrats, the one that writes the legislature's version of the state budget to purchase this part of the Pelican River Forest. But Republicans, led by the state senator for that area, Mary Felskowski, they voted to kill the project. All 4 Democrats on the committee voted to fund it. And Felskowski and others have made numerous comments that the folks with Partners in Forestry and other supporters say is misrepresenting what the project is. And Felskowski has made comments on Wisconsin Public Radio. She's made comments at, you know, county board and town board meetings, saying that her opposition is rooted in part on a lack of housing. There's a lack of land out there for young people to purchase and to purchase privately, which sounds rather dubious to me. You know, there is this 56,000 acres. There's still a lot more out there. And frankly, a lot of that land is being purchased not by young families, but by people looking to retire up north who can afford to purchase a couple of acres of land in the North Woods. But that's what Felskowski is claiming. She's also claiming that local governments and school districts in her district are already struggling right now with tight budgets, and that you can't be taking this kind of land off the tax rolls. Well, are you familiar with the meme about the guy in the hot dog suit? That's Mary Felskowski. She's in a hot dog suit right now saying, "We are all trying to find out who did this," when she talks about how local governments and her school districts are struggling right now. Who is it that's responsible for school districts and local governments up north to be struggling with tight budgets? I hope Mary Felskowski in a hot dog suit is able to find the person who did this. Somebody hand her a mirror. Now, under the purchase plan, the land would have been left in an undeveloped state with public access for hunting, fishing, trapping, motorized recreation, snowmobilers, four-wheelers. It is private land now. It would stay private land. It's just that the easement would have no impact on tax collections. So if you're losing out on any tax funds, it's because you're not allowing, say, a golf course to go there or a strip mall. You won't be getting the tax revenue from that use. You'll be getting it from use by people who will commit to keeping it as recreational and working forest land and other smart development. This land has been on tax rolls in a state tax law program for decades, and that wouldn't change. So what is at issue here? If it's not just for the sake of developers doing whatever they want with it, there's some folks that are now asking if this maybe has something to do with the unending proposals to dig it all up and put sulfide mining in there. Currently, Canadian-owned Greenlight Metals is acquiring property and mineral rights for potential copper, zinc, and gold deposits across northern Wisconsin. Now, they are the latest version of a company that has already drilled some exploration holes on managed forest land in Oneida County. And it's certainly concerning some people that the same politicians who voted in the past to bring sulfide mining to Wisconsin are the ones who are against conserving the land in the Pelican River Initiative. So I think it's more than time, past time, to ask Senator Felskowski and others to give us their definition of development when they say they want to protect the land for potential development. Because here's the kicker. If this project isn't approved by the end of the fiscal year, that $11 million in federal Forest Service funding goes away. It will go to tourism and land conservation, but in a different state, which, when you think about it, is actually completely in line with Wisconsin Republicans, who have also turned away federal dollars for health care through Medicaid expansion. They've turned away federal dollars to expand passenger rail and help tie Wisconsin together and grow its economy. So here they are sitting on a $7 billion surplus. They're proposing a flat tax for the very wealthy. They're trying to protect developers and maybe even mining developers and sending back federal money that would otherwise benefit Wisconsin. It all seems to be very much on brand. Mark's calling in, normally from the SAC, convalescing. Mark, good morning. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning, and people should be reminded, as you carefully pointed out, for these conservation easements that the state acquires, that it frequently requires that, unless there's a good conservation reason or safety reason, that hunting and fishing, consumptive activities, is to be allowed, and that if the land is to be properly managed, some logging can go on, because that's actually good for the wildlife, because Climax Forest, and people maybe look that up, is not good for wildlife. But the wildlife does best, a lot of wildlife does best in mixed forests where there's some clear cut to go on, and that the aspen regeneration. I'm not familiar with this particular property up there, but I know that that wildlife can thrive, with forestry, proper forest management. My suspicion got raised as well when you started talking about the mining company going in there and just turning it into, it can be horrible. Sulfate mining is horrible.
It could turn into such a mess, Mark. Oh my God, it totally could. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Have a great Thursday. That is such a real concern. At first, I was all thinking about, is it just, that they're protecting developers who want the option to come in? But when you look at the mining aspect of it, it is rather concerning. All right, let me set up our next interview in case you missed it. A few weeks back, we talked to Kyle Kaminsky from our sister publication, The Gander, over in Michigan. Michigan has legalized marijuana for the past couple of years here. Wisconsin's an outlier. And one of the few Republicans willing to speak out in support of at least partial legalization says the odds are unlikely without some big strings. And guess who that person is? It's Mary Felskowski, our friend from this segment. Well, 3 weeks ago, at a forum put on by the Wisconsin Policy Forum, a nonpartisan group that studies these issues. She said that among her Republican colleagues, quote, smoking is off the table, claiming that members are concerned about secondhand smoke affecting small children. I'm a little doubtful, but hey, if it's a convenient line to use. She says any bill to allow medical use will likely focus on tinctures, oils, and patches. Meanwhile, Senate Democratic Leader Melissa Agard says the most dangerous thing about marijuana in Wisconsin is that it remains illegal, that prohibition hasn't worked in the past, and that 60% of Wisconsin residents support full legalization. Our interview with Kyle Kaminsky coming up next. You're up north. We want to take a second to talk about legalized marijuana and something where Wisconsin continues to be an outlier, frankly, across the upper Midwest. And so we thought we would check in maybe with a couple of our other neighboring states and see what we could learn. Is Wisconsin missing out on benefits? Is Wisconsin missing out on problems? How would this work? So we stayed in-house first because it turns out that one of the leading journalists in Michigan, which legalized pot a couple of years back, is one of our Courier Newsroom colleagues, Kyle Kaminsky from The Gander, and who works on a newsletter called The Michiganja Report. They do not lack for punnage in the state of Michigan. And Kyle joins us now. Kyle, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Pretty good, Pat. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for helping fill us in and enlighten us on, legal marijuana and, the highs and lows, no pun intended, from it. I don't know if we have to go all the way back to when the earth cooled, but let's get pretty close. States at some point started the ball rolling on saying, we're tired of treating this as something on an equal level to, crack cocaine or nuclear weapons or whatever the case may be. Can you give us just a little background on what happened right before and during the decision to legalize marijuana in Michigan?
Michigan jumped into the game in 2018, and that's really when I arrived on the scene and realized that this would be a fun industry to cover, and didn't quite realize how lucrative it would be, though. 5 years later, we're now looking at like a $2.3 billion in sales in 2022, poised to continue growing. So it's definitely, I think, outpaced initial expectations in terms of just popularity. But yeah, for a little 4-5 years now in Michigan.
Okay. All right. And now, again, now we'll acknowledge your these good points about it. There are these bad points about it. So let's start with the benefits. And again, apologies if we're having any internet glitches here. But as we ride through those, Kyle, what's your general overview of the pros and cons in Michigan since legalization took place?
Well, the pros are obviously a lot of money. This is a big market, and that money equals tax revenue for the state as well. I just got some quick statistics here. We're looking at more than 1,000 grow operations licensed in Michigan, more than 600 retailers since legalization, sold $5.4 billion in cannabis products, hit a monthly high in December of $208 million. It's an industry that's really taken off to the point where it's actually outpaced our prior largest agricultural commodity of the dairy industry, $2.1 billion in sales in 2021, and marijuana has now overtaken that. And along with that's a whole lot of tax revenue. We just got a report yesterday from last year's sales, $198.4 million in tax revenue for Michigan. That's split between about $70 million to the transportation fund, $70 million to schools, and another $60 million going back to the local cities and counties that allow it. So, yeah, a lot of money. Yeah.
And it's worth noting that, not all that money is coming from Michigan. It's coming from people in Wisconsin. The Wisconsin Policy Forum put together a report very recently talking about the experiences in Michigan and Illinois and notes that as of this month, 3 out of every 10 Wisconsin residents above the age of 21 live within an hour's drive of a legally operating recreational marijuana dispensary in one of those states. If you increase it to a 75-minute drive, half of all Wisconsin legal age residents are that close to a recreational dispensary. So that's Wisconsin money that's now going to Michigan schools and other Michigan resources. But let's stop right there and let's come to the other side of things. You've had some time to look at this. I'm sure you've talked to law enforcement and others. What have been the drawbacks since the decision to legalize marijuana in Michigan?
Honestly, I don't see a whole lot of drawbacks. I think there was a lot of fear at the beginning that there was going to be like undue odors in neighborhoods from grow operations. Covering it at the local level, there's a lot of concern about where these facilities would be located. Would they increase crime in neighborhoods? And frankly, we're just not seeing that. These stores, for the most part, look like Apple stores. I mean, they have their own in-house security. They have a whole section of the industry dedicated to secure transportation. I think it was a lot of fears of the unknown that might have triggered some of the reluctance in the early days in 2018. But in terms of consequences of any of that, we're not seeing it.
Does that include as well, the only time I'd ever heard much of a concern was related to Colorado's decision, and that there were instances or a slight increase in impaired driving. And I'll be honest, that was now literally years ago, and I don't know that I've ever seen any kind of a follow-up on that. Is there anything even anecdotal indicating that in Michigan?
Nothing that I've heard. I mean, I know there are challenges with determining how you were impaired on marijuana. There was a report that came out at least a couple of years ago now on is marijuana in the bloodstream an adequate measure of are you impaired? I think just determining impairment for marijuana is one of the more difficult things. Because some people will smoke a joint and they will be unsafe to drive. Some people don't. It's difficult to tell. There's not a blood alcohol test like there is for alcohol for marijuana. So in terms of impaired driving, I'm sure there are more drivers on the road smoking because it's more available. Is it posing a safety issue? Nothing that I've seen.
The report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum notes that, again, the any evidence of the impact on things like car crashes has been anecdotal at best from states like Michigan, and that lawmakers will simply have to take that into consideration as they draft and consider their own marijuana legislation. So whether we're talking about, you know, impaired driving standards or anything like that, would there be, let's now turn you into an unpaid consultant for the Wisconsin legislature. Right. Is there anything in there? Obviously, it sounds like there's a lot that Wisconsin could borrow from Michigan, but if you were to suggest making any changes to the policy, anything to clarify, anything like, you know, that now that you get the gift of hindsight, what kinds of advice might you offer there?
At the beginning of the industry, there was a lot of focus on having the money to get involved. There were capitalization requirements for retailers, and it made it difficult for sort of your mom and pop operations to get started in the industry. So at the onset, we saw multi-million, billion-dollar companies really take it and run with it because they had the cash to do it. It made licensing easier, and I think there could have been a more dedicated focus to letting your local smaller operations get started in the industry without having billions of dollars to get started. That takes a concerted focus on social equity. It's can't just kind of open the doors because then your richest corporate folks are going to come in and dominate. You'll have the Walmart of pot.
That, you know, I hadn't even thought of that. That is, I mean, do you basically need a legislature to choose one direction or the other to let this be more of a big business enterprise or to take steps to encourage, you know, local, you know, Wisconsin-based, even, you know, family ownership?
Part of the legislation in Michigan formed the Cannabis Regulatory Agency and really left all of the decisions on licensing in that state agency. And there's been some evolution over the last few years. I think we're in a good place now in terms of how licenses are issued. It's no longer a political board that's voting on individual applications. It's being processed through a state licensing arm. So there are learning curves and just fairness in licensing that I think every state that enters cannabis is going to have to go through. But creating the resources of a dedicated agency to handle it, I think, is a smart move.
I get the indication from a Pew report about this that there are, again, these are more, it's not so much about whether to legalize, but again, the implementation of it. And that is making sure that dispensaries, especially the family run ones, you know, understand exactly, you know, what they're allowed to sell and what is the, you know, the amount of THC that can be involved in these products. And that there sounds like there also might need to be more public education so that police say more people need to understand what the limits of the law are in terms of how much they can possess before they, you know, run afoul of possession, you know, statutes that might be in place. Do those things, again, sound like kind of just the working out the details that are going to be a possible, are going to be needed to address in any state?
More or less. I mean, we have, I think it's a 2.5 ounce limit on purchases in Michigan. That's it's cool to have, but in reality, nobody's really walking around with that much marijuana. And especially if you're going to the retail store, you're going to buy a $40 bag. So the limit is essentially meaningless. Mm-hmm. I think it stops your kind of bulk. The idea is to curb the black market. You don't want folks going into the retail store, buying a bulk amount of product, turning around and selling it unlicensed on their own.
You've talked about a Walmart of pot, but we don't want a Costco or a Sam's Club of pot, basically.
Yes, exactly.
Is what we're getting at here.
It's important to note, I think in Michigan, we have a two-stage licensing approach. So in order to have approval to operate a retailer, you have to have approval from your local municipality as well as the state. So this gives local communities the opportunity to decide whether or not cannabis is something they want in their community. I mean, voters approved it majority in Michigan, but it still comes down to the local level of whether it's a fit for your community. Most municipalities in Michigan have opted out, but the industry has still been able to thrive.
Look, from meth to fentanyl to, you know, other drug crises that especially rural parts of the Midwest have faced, I am wondering if this move appears to have made any kind of a dent in Michigan, where, you know, there are folks there that with pot being legal are less likely to engage in, you know, either creating or buying meth and other substances. Is there anything that indicates there's been a change on that front in Michigan?
People, if you want to smoke weed, are going to get weed, whether it's through the legal system or not. So I think the state, by creating the opportunity to get it safely and legally, has really, you don't know what comes in a bag of weed when you're buying it from a friend down the corner. You might have trusted folks, but at the end of the day, it's not tested like it is in the retail market. So I think just consumer product safety goes a long way in having a licensed market as well.
Now, for the Gander, our sister publication in Michigan, you also put together what you call the Michiganja Report. It is a free newsletter that you would sign up for at gandernewsroom.com. And I'm looking at one of your recent editions here, and I'm just going to rattle off the five headlines, and then you can pick one of them if you want to talk about. But the headlines include pot shops get creative, black market crackdown, some cities still snub pot, Hoosiers want to get high, talking about the traffic there from Indiana, and black owned pot shops, which seems appropriate for Black History Month. Those sound like very typical things that you're working on. So even though you covered legalization, there is still a regular beat for you to work on a regular basis here, it sounds like.
Oh yeah, it's a huge market. You know, the Hoosiers want to get high one is interesting, because these are all folks that live in Indiana that want access to marijuana, and they're driving across the border and giving their tax money to Michigan in order to get it. So I'm keep on coming. You know, I think that's a good example of the opportunities that are being missed by not legalizing marijuana.
And then you look at the things that, when you talk about, when I mentioned get creative, your article there says, you know, one place is offering a free night of skiing at a resort for customers who spend $50. Another can get a chance to drive off in a new Ford Bronco. So there's certainly no shortage of ways that good old fashioned entrepreneurship can get involved with this new industry.
Yeah. Well, with more than 600 retailers, you got to find a way to get creative to get those sales. And Yeah, there's no shortage of interesting ways. I did get interested in that Bronco one though, so I might
Bet you did.
actually switching retailers here.
Kyle Kaminsky, from the Gander and the Michiganger Report. We really appreciate all the background. Thank you so much for taking some time to visit with us, and we may need to call in your expertise again soon.
Anytime. Thanks, Pat.
Number one song on this day in 1974, TSOP, The Sound of Philadelphia, the theme for Soul Train, done by the group MFSB, which stands for Mother, Father, Sister, Brother. The group was established by Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff at Philadelphia International Records, and the ladies that you hear on there, 3 Degrees. They also had a hit later with When Will I See You Again? We played a little Tito Puente earlier. He was born on this day 100 years ago. Today would have been Tito Puente's 100th birthday. He passed away in the year 2000. Mambo drummer, Latin jazz composer. And when we played Oye Como Va and was explaining that Santana is better known for doing the remake in 1970 compared to his original cha-cha version in 1962, apparently he was very unhappy in the beginning that a rock band had done a remake of his song, and then he says he received his first royalty check, and then it was all good, and now he would praise Santana up and down. Keep the money coming, baby.
That's pretty funny.
It is. You know, the answer to all your questions is money. Actor George Takei, 86 years old today, from Star Trek, but more recently from social media and LGBTQ advocacy and being funnier than any right-winger who tries to own the libs. Jessica Lange, the actress, is 74 years old today. Andy Serkis, actor best known for pioneering work in motion capture technology. You want to tell us more about Andy here, Aaron?
Yeah, so he has worked on basically any big movie that's had a CG character that's human-like, such as Gollum or Caesar in Planet of the Apes. He's the one wearing, you might see in those behind the scenes, a big black suit with a bunch of white dots on it. He's the one wearing those, and the computer tracks the white dots, and then they can use it to capture a performance and use it to animate a digital character.
Pretty nice. Okay, so he's exactly my age, 59. He turns 59 a few weeks before me, and I haven't done anything remotely close to that. So thanks, Andy. Thanks for making me feel bad. 56 years old today is Mike Portnoy, drummer, best known for his work with the progressive metal band Dream Theater. And the person you... Is this Fife Dog from A Tribe Called Quest, Aaron?
Yes.
All right. Malik Taylor was born on this day in 1970, passed away in 2016. Hey, Aaron, before we go to the next song and more about the history, let's do this. I don't want to forget again to give away those Brewers tickets. They're great tickets. 2 tickets to see the Brewers against the Red Sox Sunday afternoon. And if nobody claims them today, then we're going to give away 4 tickets tomorrow or 2 more tickets tomorrow. But let's do this while you're playing clips in case folks want to call in. I'm never going to give you a stumper because we want to give away the tickets, but you do got to call in and say, hey, look, Craig Council has been managing the Brewers since 2015. Do you remember who the manager was before? Who was the manager of the Brewers right before Craig Council? He managed for 5 seasons. So you know, you can give us a call here at 715-388-7155 or 844-967-2789. If the phone's ringing, just let it go because Aaron's also busy playing clips for me here. Like this one from Night Shift. It was the Commodores' first and only hit after Lionel Richie left the group. I, of course, had to send the answer to Aaron because I totally caught him off guard about that, so I had to type it over to him. Anyway, yeah, that was the one time the Commodores had a hit after Lionel Richie left the band. It was a number one hit in 1985, their tribute to Jackie Wilson and Marvin Gaye. On this day in 1836, Congress passed an act creating the Wisconsin Territory. So we were on our way to statehood at that point on this day in 1836. Now we turn to 1993 and an entrepreneur named Lou Pearlman. He'd been looking at the success of New Kids on the Block and thought, I can create a boy band. So he auditioned hundreds of performers and chose five unknowns to become the Backstreet Boys, whose first hit single was Quit Playing Games With My Heart.
Quit playing games with my heart.
Yeah, I know. I said that. So there you go. They are kind of the Monkees to the Beatles. Something like that. Yes? No? I don't know.
Yeah, more or less.
It's the analogy is not quite there. The Backstreet Boys weren't given their own Saturday morning TV show. I saw you got one call in. Did we get a winner for the tickets on the first try?
We did not.
Oh, okay. So still out there that if you know who managed the Brewers before Craig Counsell and you call 844-967-2789 and can go to Sunday's Brewers game against Boston, 1:10 in the afternoon, we can email the tickets to you. So let's see. Shania Twain released her self-titled debut album this day in 1993. Her hits wouldn't come until later albums. On this day in 2010, the Deepwater Horizon drilling rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico, killing 11 workers and starting an oil spill that would last for 6 months. On this day in 2002, Ashanti's self-titled debut album topped the album chart. She held the number one spot on the singles chart as well with Foolish. Number two was Always On Time, her collaboration with Ja Rule. Again, that's 2002. All right, Aaron, we got one more birthday. Do you want to tell us whose birthday it is before you have to take some more phone calls?
Happy birthday, Mom.
Hey, Aaron's mom. Happy birthday. All right, let's tell everybody how old she is. I'm kidding.
No, that's okay.
Kidding. Do not do that. Aaron's mom, happy birthday. I'm guessing she's up in Manitowoc since that's where Aaron goes home to all the time. So, again, Aaron is taking calls from people guessing who is the Brewers manager before it was old Craig Counsell. I was looking at the list of them here. I can tell you who it's not. It's not Ken Maka or Dale Swaim. It's not Ned Yost or Jerry Royster or Davey Lopes or old Scrap Iron Phil Garner or Tom Trebelhorn. If I wanted to give a tough question, I would have said, you know, who were the two Brewers managers that served two different times as Brewers managers? And of course, any diehard fan will tell you it's both Harvey Keen and George Bamberger. Harvey Keen came back after a 7-year absence, and Bambi came back after a 5-year absence to manage the team. There have been 19 individuals overall who have served as Brewers manager since things began with the Seattle Pilots moving to Milwaukee after the 1969 season. Joe Schultz was the manager there. Dave Bristol was the first one in 1970. Aaron, is Corey from Watertown?
Yes, Corey from Watertown.
Hey, Corey, are you with us?
Yeah, hi, good morning.
Hey, okay, sounds like you're in the car. Keep those hands at 10 and 2. And tell us who managed the Brewers before Craig Counsell.
It is Ron Renneke.
That is exactly it. All right. And you can put a couple of tickets to use on Sunday if we email them to you?
Oh, definitely.
All right. Good deal. I'm going to make sure that you get that address from Aaron. And thanks so much for calling in. Have a great day. Put you on hold, and we will talk to Katrina Shanklin, state representative, coming up right after this news break. You're up north.
Come on, sing with me. See, when I get the strength to leave, you always tell me that you need me. And I'm weak because I believe you. And I'm mad because I love you. So I stop and think that maybe.